Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Marjorie Godfrey, a national leader in designing improvement strategies in healthcare delivery. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare reports on a device that relays your location to emergency contacts in the event of an accident. And we begin with this week's Bright Idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Smoking remains one of the world's leading causes of preventable death, and yet quitting is still a challenge for so many smokers. Pregnant women who smoke pose a greater health risk to their growing babies, increasing the likelihood for preterm birth and other lifelong health consequences. And that's to say nothing of the health danger for infants exposed to secondhand smoke. A recent study published in the Journal of Women's Health highlights another promising intervention, municipal smoking bans. Municipal smoking bans are a relatively recent phenomenon, so there's been very little study of their impact on maternal smoking cessation and infant health until now. In 2003, Pueblo, Colorado initiated a citywide smoking ban that was strictly enforced. Researchers compared Pueblo to El Paso, Colorado, which had similar population demographics but no municipal smoking ban. During a two-year period, they compared maternal smoking rates in each city and infant health statistics as well. And what they found was pretty astonishing. 38% fewer pregnant women in Pueblo smoked, and there were 23% fewer preterm births compared to the maternal and infant population in El Paso. They say the smoking ban had a direct, improving impact on maternal and infant health in a short period of time. The report suggests that the evidence should be fodder for communities around the nation to consider following suit. A strongly enforced municipal ban on smoking, leading to significant improvements in maternal and infant health outcomes, not to mention for the entire community, now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Marjorie Godfrey. She's the director of the Dartmouth Institute's Microsystem Academy and is an instructor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Marjorie is a national leader in designing improvement strategies in healthcare delivery, targeting the places where patients, families, and care teams meet. Ms. Godfrey has consulted and collaborated with numerous health systems around the country, as well as in many countries around the world, and is author of the textbook Quality by Design. She is the chief author and architect of Clinical Microsystems Resource Group, A Path to Healthcare Excellence. Marjorie, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking with you today, Mark.
You know, I think the term clinical microsystems is not part of the common language of healthcare. It's really sort of a connoisseur's term for great health systems. And you're a registered nurse, but also someone who has consulted numerous healthcare organizations around the world on how to improve their delivery system by focusing in on the clinical microsystems. So tell our listeners, if you would, where the term comes from and what's unique about clinical microsystems in the healthcare setting and why are they so essential in improving quality?
Well, thank you for this opportunity. The clinical microsystem term actually emerged from research that had been done in the business world. So as researchers at Dartmouth, when we were trying to study and understand what really makes a difference in improving healthcare, something about this interface between patients, families, interprofessionals at a front line of care, we stumbled across this book by James Brian Quinn at the Tuck School of Business. And the name of the book was Intelligent Enterprise. And what Brian's research group found was that high-performing organizations in the service industry had several features that led to their success and helped describe the senior leaders of the organization had an obsession with the interface between employees and customers receiving services and goods. And in that intersection, there was high value being exchanged, there was standardization of processes, there was an incredible use of technology that was available. And what he found in these high-performing service industry units was that the loyalty to the company was extremely high. Customers were extremely satisfied, and staff were happy. Well, when we read the book in our journey of trying to understand how to improve healthcare, Brian coined a phrase called the smallest replicable unit, SRU. And when Paul Batalden and Gene Nelson looked at the book, they thought, huh, I wonder what that is in healthcare. And we actually ended up coining the smallest replicable unit to be a small system, hence microsystem. So what is the smallest unit of healthcare delivery in any healthcare system? It's the interface between patients, families, doctors, nurses, secretaries, receptionists, and that would be called a microsystem of the healthcare system. So we added clinical microsystem to that to indicate that we were talking about the clinical setting where care and services are provided, where we interact with patients and families, and it involves all professionals and staff. And how do we study that small unit to understand how it can be the most effective, efficient, safe, timely, accessible, and patient-centered? And core to the clinical microsystem theory, if you will, is in the center of all this is the patient and family that should be driving the care and services that we provide and continuously improve.
So maybe go on from that to tell us, how does the clinical microsystem model differ from what people are used to hearing about as performance improvement models or strategies like Six Sigma or like Lean? What's unique about the clinical microsystem model as it relates specifically to improving quality in healthcare delivery?
The clinical microsystem is really about understanding the context. Where are we providing care and services? What are the unique particularities about the people, the populations we care for? How do we do our work? And then what is our culture like? What is the leadership culture like? Do we have traditions and cultures and celebrations? What's our performance data? That's really what the clinical microsystem is. Every day we have microsystems that are either being studied or not, being improved or not, but every day these units are providing care and services. So it's understanding the context. Once you understand that context, there's a whole collection of methodologies for improvement. Often what I hear from those that I work with, the interprofessionals at the front line, is they will tell me that they've been given a directive by their leaders to, for example, in an ambulatory setting, improve access to care. And by being able to understand the particularities of our setting and how we currently do our work, and by the way, maybe we define and improve access differently for a subpopulation of our patients who are over 75 years old. Maybe we do it differently for the working population. And that's what understanding our context helps inform which tool to use at the right time from an improvement perspective. And often what's missing is the deep understanding of the context, which is what clinical microsystems brings to the whole scene of improving healthcare.
Marjorie, how do you take these principles to, let's say, an emergency room setting or a critical care hospital? And are there different approaches that work better for different types of healthcare organizations? And if so, what can we learn from these differences?
Well, that's a really good question, too. And I think that's one of the desirable characteristics of focusing on systems within systems of microsystems is that it can be easily adapted in any healthcare setting where care and services are being provided. So, for example, you talk about the emergency room. How often are the conditions created for all of the professionals, including the paramedics, the emergency response team, respiratory therapy, to get together and talk about how do we do our work? And the tools that we've developed, one particular is called the 5 P's. The 5 P's is really about understanding these particularities that I was talking about and letting those at the front line collect and add to system data. That's where we gather all the information from those doing the work, because even Toyota has taught us those closest to the work have the best knowledge of what's working well, what isn't working. And by the way, they usually have good ideas, but it's the rare organization that tries to harness that information and leverage it and invite those interprofessionals to come together and have the reflection time to help contribute to making improvements. And across all of those high-performing units that we found these success characteristics about in the categories of leadership at the front line, support by the larger organization, staff development, selecting the right team to come to work and helping them develop and grow, and then importantly is having a standard way to do improvement, that we have a common language in our organization, that it's not everybody does any kind of improvement they want in a disorganized way, but we have a standard methodology that we all agree to, we're trained in, we're supported in doing that. Those at the front line are deeply involved. And then tying this all together was the fact that there was information and information technology. How can information technology permeate the organization and the journey of the patient across multiple microsystems to be able to inform all the units and have a shared information environment?
Marjorie, we all read and hear that America spends so much more money than any other industrialized nation on healthcare, but overall, we get poorer outcomes when compared to those countries. And I know that you have been all around the world. So you've been in the UK, Sweden, Japan, and Canada. What have you learned there about what they do that should inform our health system quality improvement methods here in the United States?
Well, that's a complex question, Margaret. I don't know if that's fair, but but a few things that I've learned is the principles and the theory of microsystems can be applied in any country. And when you start engaging very busy healthcare professionals with patients and families at the front line of care, you quickly learn that the issues that we have in the United States are the same in Sweden and England and Scotland and Ireland and Canada and New Zealand. And what happens is the engagement of frontline staff is varied across different settings. So the beauty of the microsystem work is it honors the local context and the systems within systems. So if we look at, say, for example, as you pointed out, where I'm completing my doctoral studies in Sweden, they have a sense of collectivism there in Sweden, which is a wonderful experience for me to have compared to how I've lived here in the United States. My colleagues in other countries frequently ask, they don't understand why we don't want everyone to have health insurance, because they've grown up in that culture and they understand the benefits of a healthy population. So let's go back to Sweden a bit, in that with their governance and budget structure, what's really cool and why they get such great outcomes is, for example, in Jönköping County in southern Sweden, that whole county has a governance body that works closely with the municipalities, that works closely with the healthcare system, that also works closely with the professional education schools to figure out how can we all get together and improve the care of the population, because we know if we improve the population health, we'll have money and resources for other necessary things in the communities, like bike paths and other programs. And I really think they have this collective vision for their population that makes a difference in the outcomes that they're getting. And Jönköping actually has some of the best outcomes in the world. We've been working with them, we being from Dartmouth, have been working with Jönköping County since 1999. They have focused on intentionally and had a strategic plan and map since 1999 that they have moved through methodically to be sure leaders are developed at all levels, that staff understand improvement, that they've got patients and families actively involved, and to the point that in the past few years they've actually developed a dialysis unit where the dialysis, hemodialysis, is completed by the patients. And you kind of think about that and raise your eyebrows here in the United States. How could we have a patient do self-administered hemodialysis? They've done it because they've taken the value that it brings to patients and families. Patients express the interest to do this. They change their processes. They're getting better outcomes. People are feeling better. Staff are delighted to be more in a support role. And it just, to me, is an illustration. If you take these principles and improvement and really look for high-value, low-cost options of the innovation that you can develop.
We're speaking today with Marjorie Godfrey. She's the director of the Dartmouth Institute's Microsystems Academy and is an instructor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Marjorie is a national leader in designing improvement strategies in healthcare delivery and has consulted and collaborated with numerous health systems around the country. We're all quite interested in new approaches to training the next generation of medical professionals and training them to our model of care. What qualities make up a leader within the clinical microsystems model?
That's another good question. I think the leaders that we've seen, this has been an emerging, well, actually, I think it's transformational what's happening with leadership now. We have a responsibility when we're working with frontline teams to inform the leaders that these teams are going to be different, which means you probably are going to need to lead differently. And it really takes some self-reflection on the current leaders to decide if they want to be in that model or not. And one of the key behaviors of these leaders is the ability to gain knowledge. So gain knowledge about how patients are cared for, gain knowledge about improvement, gain more knowledge about what patients and families think about the care. And based on that knowledge, be able to take action. So what kind of action, how would a leader act differently? And we've got lots of verbatims and experiences of leaders who, many of the listeners have heard the stories of the safety rounds where the leader is out of the executive suite, out on the unit. And then there's this other behavior that's really hard for leaders to engage in, and it's review and reflection. How can you build time in your calendars to step back and say, based on what I've learned and what we've put into action, how is it going? What's going well? What do I need to do differently? How might we further engage frontline staff? And what am I doing to help or hinder the process? Now, leadership, there's so many business books written on this that you can pick any model that you want. But what we find is really important is focusing that leader on the front line. What does the leader do in the microsystem with the staff and promote and develop and raise up all of the staff to be involved? What does the leader do in the middle of the organization where you have multiple microsystems, where patients' journeys have them cross the multiple places? How do leaders in the middle act differently? And we actually have a new program we're developing where it's all about understanding feed forward and feedback between microsystems. It's all about coaching in the middle, where you want to be able to coach awareness, create conditions so multiple microsystems will come together and meet. So creating the conditions. And then, of course, at the top of the organization, like you and Margaret, being the macro system leader, if you will, is really having the vision and interpreting all these incoming missiles we have in healthcare in an ever-changing environment, particularly around the Affordable Care Act, and what does this mean for me with core measures. So leadership in healthcare is not an easy task anymore. The other little nugget, I just came from the Cystic Fibrosis National Meeting, and we've started this new program with leaders of CF centers. And what kicked it all off is we started with a 360 review of the leaders and their ability to lead quality and improvement. And it's been quite illuminating for the leaders, their perceptions compared to those that report to them and other peers' perceptions, that I really felt a new energy and a sense from leaders, I really need this help. I don't know how to do this. I've been trying to make it up along the way. I'm welcoming this opportunity to learn how to lead quality and improvement. So
very fascinating. And Marjorie, if I can ask you to just speak for a moment to what I think is one of the most intriguing aspects of the model you've developed. It's the role of coaches within these clinical microsystems. Coaches, not consultants, not bringing somebody in from the outside, but rather training people broad-based to be coaches within their own clinical microsystems. Maybe for our listeners, just a moment or two on who these coaches are and the skills that you impart to them.
There's been so much work done in building teams and teamworks and just a lot of work coming out on effective teams and recognizing the fact that it's not one hero provider anymore that provides the care and services. It's actually a collection of different professions and disciplines coming together. And my research has actually shown, and there's research in the literature also, that in our attempts to try to provide care and improve care, we've often given frontline teams the mission to improve the core measures or improve access, and here's a PDSA, or maybe we'll spend a day together learning about improvement, and then the frontline has been left on their own. And what we have found in research is that those teams that maybe get the improvement knowledge and then get some help, they get someone reminding them, encouraging them. It's very exciting. And the neat thing is most often in most organizations, we're not looking to hire a troop of coaches as much as using this, leveraging from an OD perspective or human resource perspective. Who are the individuals? Mm-hmm. How can we leverage their expertise and their interest in growing people to be able to do their job and also coach others to do it? And it's very rewarding. It can be seen as an advancement for someone. The coaching is truly a developmental journey where we're helping to support people to learn, to be able to know that they can provide care and improve care. But having that human interaction and encouragement is what's made such a big difference in these groups to be able to move forward, to transform themselves, to be able to provide care and improve care.
We've been speaking today with Marjorie Godfrey. She is the director of the Dartmouth Institute Microsystem Academy and an instructor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Marjorie is a national leader in designing improvement strategies in healthcare delivery, and you can find much more about her work by going to clinicalmicrosystem.org. Marjorie, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. Imagine you're out for a long bike ride by yourself when something causes you to crash. You're alone, far from home, and maybe rendered immobile by an injury. That thought crossed Bijou Thomas's mind a few years ago when the elite athlete restaurateur was out cycling and the exact thing happened to him.
I'm laying on the side of the road thinking, here I am. If I was really hurt, really injured, nobody knows who I am. Nobody knows who my friends or family are. No one knows if there's anything wrong with me or any physical issues or medical conditions. My thought was there's got to be a way to create a device that triggers a phone for you.
Bijou Thomas in a promotional video. So Thomas cooked up a pretty cool idea. The Ice Dot, a sensor that attaches to the helmet that links to an app on your smartphone. It has a list of emergency contacts who are alerted if you've had an accident. He teamed up with developer Chris Zentaver, who developed the system to work pretty seamlessly, right down to texting the rider's GPS coordinates to the emergency contacts.
So you're out on a ride, take an impact, and the sensor starts a countdown. You can configure this countdown to last as much as 2 minutes. I've got this set for 15 seconds right now. If I don't turn it off, it's going to alert my emergency contacts of my GPS coordinates via text message.
The Ice Dot can be adapted to all kinds of action sports realities, motocross, snow sports, BMX riders, skateboarders, all of whom are vulnerable to accidents. Bluetooth selected the Ice Dot as the number one technology innovation for sports back in 2010. Ice Dot's developers are currently scaling up their operation to make it more accessible to all active sports enthusiasts. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.